Welcome to Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo, number 280. The home station is CFUR at 88.7 FM, with rebroadcasts on CJLY in Nelson, Kootenai Lake, and CHLS in Lillooet. There, I got it right that time. Last month, my wife and I lost a good friend. Bob McKellar succumbed to a number of infirmities after a long and active life. He was not young. He had been an RCAF tail gunner in World War II bomber squadron. In the course of his life, Bob did many things in many places and acquired many fast friends. This was evidenced last Saturday evening at a Civic Center dinner sponsored by Bob's widow, Joy. More than 50 of those friends gathered from far and wide to honor his memory. Bob was not religious. He had no funeral, no burial, no cremation. Bob's body was donated to the UBC Medical School. At Bob's farewell get-together, there were no preachers, no weeping, no somber black suits. The room was decorated with photos and mementos of Bob's life. This was a celebration of his life. After drinks and dinner, the evening was devoted to anecdotes from people who knew and worked with Bob over the years. I regret that many of their testimonials escaped my poor hearing, but I got the gist of them. Everyone who knew Bob found him a gentle, caring man. He was a positive influence in the lives of many, co-workers, friends, and clients. In most of his working life, Bob served the corrections branch, initially as a probation officer, and finally as a district director of the North Central region of BC, overseeing probation services for a third of the province. Friend after friend arose to testify as to Bob's performance as worker, mentor, companion, and supervisor. His management philosophy revolved around a belief that those he supervised were trusted agents to be given free rein to do their jobs. When they were right, he backed them up. When they screwed up, he defended them, then they had to answer to him. His operative rule was, do the right thing, and he took his role of public servant seriously, something that many of our elected representatives fail to do. Without being religious, I think that Bob was a better Christian than most of those I know who wear their beliefs on their sleeves while weaseling their way through life, and I didn't mention the word Bush anywhere in that sentence. I never worked for Bob, but I knew him through my work when I was a secretary to the Regional Director of Corrections, Bob's immediate supervisor. I learned a lot about human beings on that job, and Bob was one of the final examples of a rather flawed species. At Bob's memorial, the stories went on well past my bedtime, so I resisted the temptation to relate a couple of my own anecdotes. A plea was made there to record such anecdotes so they would not die with us. I will add a couple of my own here, as Joy is a regular listener to these shows. While I was in that regional office job, the province was in the process of labeling our vast fleet of vehicles with standard markings. Some of these you may still see, in spite of subsequent government selling off the fleet in its wisdom and leasing them back. Bob objected to having numbers and decals fore and aft on probation vehicles. He believed that served probationers best to have visits by officers made anonymously. Bob made the empirical discovery that these new decals could be washed off by a method that could only be accomplished by males. Subsequently, many of the probation vehicles of his subordinates were thus returned to anonymity. Bob loved to read, and he read voraciously on the job. However, he was not fond of reading bureaucratic outpourings. I discovered this as one of my functions at work was to circulate documents sent from Victoria for comment. Our office dutifully made three copies of all of these outpourings and sent one to each of the district directors for their comments. I soon discovered a pattern to their replies. One director would use any document on any subject as a launching pad for fervent pleas for more vehicles, personnel, and resources for his district. Another would expend great effort in analyzing reports and make lengthy analyses of each point. And Bob? Well, we could count on Bob's returning each document with the following scrawled across the cover. I concur, RGM. These replies from the three directors were dutifully bundled and returned to Victoria, where I'm sure they were either filed or shredded. No difference. Bob seemed to be the only one to realize the futility of the exercise. As I said, Bob was an avid reader, and our material ran along the same lines. He loved Bertrand Russell, Noam Chomsky, and similar writers. At this time, I subscribed to a raft of publications like The Nation, Canadian Dimension, Briar Patch, and others of a left-wing socialist persuasion. When finished with them, I used the inter-office house mail to send them to Bob. Those he finished, he left in the lawyer's waiting room at the courthouse where he worked. I found later that the lawyers dubbed this room the Lenin Library. Neither of us minded. My wife and I will miss Bob and the occasional Sunday brunches we shared with him and Joy at the Ramada Inn. This is a difficult time for Joy, as she and Bob were happily married for 58 years. I can't imagine what it's like to lose a partner after such a long shared life. We have vowed not to let our friendship go dormant, and I'm sure that many others, those who made it to the memorial and those absent, feel the same. Bob touched many lives, not to mention the probationers whom he truly tried to guide through tough times. As someone said that night, Bob was a giant among men and will be sorely missed. In the interest of annoying as many listeners as possible, today I will take a shot at a popular art form, tattoos. Don't get me wrong, I almost bought a tattoo myself, but I passed out first. My experience with these began in Panama while in the U.S. Army. Tattoos were popular with soldiers, some of whom I saw in the morning after the operation, when they awoke with a hangover and a sore arm, chest, or leg from a fresh dose of subcutaneous ink. Ouch! Did I really do that last night? What does it say? Did he spell it right? Is that really a good rendition of a panther? I've always associated tattoos with drunken soldiers and sailors. My impression of their possessors was not boosted by the amateur artwork I saw applied in jails. The trouble with tattoos is they are so permanent. Not just that, but I can imagine that some of the ones I saw as a soldier are now sagging humorously. What might be cute on the ankle of a teen could look pretty silly on the resident of a nursing home. There, have I aroused your ire? Good. Write me an irate letter at CFUR, care of UNBC. A couple of enterprising Germans caused a stir in Berlin by opening a bar with a Stasi theme. The slogan of this place is, "Come to us, otherwise we will come to you," a sentence that may evoke bad memories in some prospective patrons. Within the bar, you can sip a beer surrounded with artifacts of the defunct East German police state. There are mannequins dressed in old riot police uniforms, handcuffs, bludgeons, and torture instruments to create atmosphere. Regular patrons can earn the title of informant and be entitled to a discount on drinks. Some see this bar's theme as an insult to the victims of the late Stasi, but others just see it as tasteless. If this bar survives, it promises to attract a strange cast of regulars. That is Germany. This is Canada. A Stasi bar here would be meaningless, but how about an Afghan theme for a gin mill? To get there, one would have to thread his way through recreations of bombed homes and sullen citizens, while avoiding mock improvised explosive devices. Drinkers could imbibe in a recreation of Abu Ghraib prison, with bloodied mud walls and floors, torture instruments, and a hideous stench of human waste and fear. Decorations could include whips, rubber hoses, and those cute little generators that produce electric shocks to the genitals. Waterboarding gear would be a centerpiece. Yes, and proceedings could be overseen by a maitre d' dressed as a CIA agent, roaming among customers casting insults and demanding to know where Osama might be. Beer slingers dressed as warders could serve as patrons chained to the walls while recorded screams play in the background. Would such a gin mill be tasteless? Sure, but isn't the real thing and the whole exercise in Afghanistan tasteless? Cast your mind back 7 years to those days when the world first lived in fear of ubiquitous terrorists among us, mailing anthrax hither, thither, and yon, inflicting this dreaded disease on the innocent. News reports of the day tied anthrax distribution to suicide bombers taking unwanted urban renewal to Washington and New York. We knew that Western civilization itself was under attack, and the mastermind of the whole project was one Osama bin Laden hiding in Afghanistan. Certainly he must be attacked, and, as unavoidable collateral damage, the government and social structure of that backward country had to be removed. Few were the voices of sanity telling us to collect evidence before rushing to war. Only after Afghanistan had been safely bombed back into the Stone Age, not a great trip, was it revealed that the anthrax spores in the post bore an uncanny resemblance to ones being bred in U.S. Army laboratories. It was difficult to pinpoint the exact source, as several Army labs were working with this disease. The Bush regime's reaction to anthrax in the mail was to boost spending on germ warfare research by a factor of 20. There are now reported to be 14,000 individuals working in labs all over the U.S. and Canada involved with dreaded diseases. It's ironic that the purported distributor of postal anthrax was a disaffected scientist in the employ of the United States government. By mandating a dramatic expansion of research on these pathogens, Bush has increased the likelihood of future leaks by giving many other potential saboteurs access to diseases. Way to go, George, always thinking before acting. I've not heard any questions raised as to why, in the face of a supposed ban on germ warfare, the American military was working with this stuff at all, and not in just one lab, but several. There's a 1972 convention prohibiting use and possession of bacteriological and toxic weapons. The loophole through which the U.S. has driven its truck is the allowance of research for defense against these weapons. Since the 1947 rebranding of the Department of War as the Department of Defense, all preparations for war have been defensive by definition. This renders all of the otherwise offensive actions, whether research or actual attacks, defensive. Slaughter of Vietnamese defended America. Invasion of Panama defended America. Development and deployment of hydrogen bombs on guided missiles is defensive. And all research on and production of pathogens is defensive, thus negating any effect of that 1972 agreement. It is not reassuring to realize that a future American incursion into Canada, perhaps to secure continuing oil exports, would be purely defensive. Canada's Prime Minister has spoken. Stephen Harper says he is appalled by the actions of Russia in Georgia and South Ossetia. He is shocked that Russia exhibits an intention to control countries on its borders. What a pity that Steve's ire was not been raised by the actions of our southern neighbor, whose reach extends far beyond its border states. If he did harbor such concerns, he would dare not give voice to them, lest he suffer retaliation from that neighbor. It's embarrassing to be a Canadian and hear our sovereign leader mouth the script written by George Bush. As to the actions of Russia and its incursions into South Ossetia, we'd all better get used to the bears flexing its muscle. Russia is back. Daddy Bush made a big mistake in reacting to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the subsequent collapse of the Soviet Union. The West didn't take the opportunity to welcome the new Russia into the community of nations as a partner, but as a conquered territory. The United States crowed over its victory over communism, sending in advisors to speed the dismantling of the social and economic structure of that country. Whole industries, formerly the property of the state, were turned over to budding capitalists at fire sale prices. From a purported egalitarian society, imperfect as it was, Russia soon became a divided nation of impoverished masses and newly minted billionaires, overseeing the appropriated assets of the people. It took a couple of decades, but with Vladimir Putin aggressively clawing back stolen assets and the sudden rise in value of its energy exports, the new Russia is a player on the world scene. As Russia accumulates huge surpluses from oil and gas exports, the collective West, with the U.S. in the forefront, is adding daily to its deficit and debts. Maybe George and Stephen needn't worry about oil trading in euros. Maybe future purchases will be made in rubles. Every edition of the Globe and Mail's business section carries an obnoxious advertisement for a law firm bragging that it is Canada's trusting tax lawyers. Behind the veil of lawyer-client confidentiality, they will negotiate a deal for those who owe taxes. Their specialties are listed as unfilled back taxes, unreported income, GST and PST arrears, and other such peccadilloes. The message is clear. If the tax man is on your tail, go to these guys and they will negotiate a deal, arranging terms anonymously under which you can escape penalties for tax dodging or illicit avoidance. These lawyers are not available to you. They shelter the big boys, ones who have escaped serious taxation. If you chisel a bit and the tax man finds out, they'll be down on you like a hammer with fines, penalties, and perhaps some jail time. A beautiful example of how the big shots get away with tax fraud is our own dear ex-Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. He committed a serious crime by taking envelopes of $1,000 bills from Karl-Heinz Schreiber and not reporting the income. Just as Revenue Canada began to close in on this omission, he seemed to have remembered it and filed a retroactive addition to a past return. He escaped without penalty. Every day we see more examples of how there is one law for the rich and one for the rest of us. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. I was still wiping tears from my eyes after hearing George Wanker Bush excoriate Russia for meddling in the affairs of other nations when I came across the most amazing indication of business as usual between the two nations. Anyone not in a coma knows that General Motors is in trouble with their bets on monster cars and trucks at a time when such dinosaurs are a hard sell. One option to generate capital would be to sell off a division or two, the prime candidate for unloading being the Hummer arm. Now, who would buy an outfit whose U.S. sales have fallen 40% in the first half of the year? Enter Russia's richest oligarch. He's interested as the Hummer brand has a high profile among the newer rich in his country. So let's assume that the Hummer is purchased and production is moved to Russia. Hummer is a civilian version of the military Humvee. The Humvee is a $100,000 replacement for the old Jeep, a throwaway utility vehicle that cost about $2,000 when I was a soldier. Since Chrysler appropriated the name Jeep from the Commons and trademarked it, I guess the government had to adjust. With the Hummer a Russian civilian vehicle, what would prevent them from producing a military version of it, perhaps calling it the Humveesky? Could Humvees and Humveeskys someday confront one another in Georgia? And if not Georgia, Europe? Or how about Georgia, USA? Bush wants to provoke more wars so that his chosen successor, John McCain, could win the presidency as the candidate with war experience. Is he ready to take on Russia? We might remember that McCain does indeed have war experience, but as a loser who was taken prisoner. While I'm on to relations with the Russians, how about our Stephen Harper leasing Russian helicopters for operations in Afghanistan? It seems that he cannot buy them before his phony 2011 deadline, so we would put out some serious money, $300 million, to use Russian ones. He has to get helicopters, as this was a condition in remaining in that war past 2009. I understand that our NATO allies have somewhere around 3,000 medium-lift chopters sitting unused. Not one of those 26 countries has offered Canada the use of any. Doesn't it make one wonder whether NATO is really behind the American occupation? Maybe, just maybe, NATO was shoehorned into a grudging participation in Afghan imbroglio by American threats and bribes. Or maybe NATO, an alliance meant to provide a coordinated defense against a possible Soviet attack, is effectively defunct. With the Soviet Union gone and their counterpart, the Warsaw Pact, dismantled, it might be time to dissolve NATO also. While gasoline prices remain stubbornly uniform and stable here in Prince George, we learned that a church group in the District of Columbia has found a way to circumvent the energy companies by going to a higher power. They've been holding pray-at-the-pump sessions at gas stations around the nation's capital. Their spokesman, Rocky Tinman, has quoted by the BBC as saying, "We don't have anybody else to turn to but God. We have to turn these problems over to God and not to man." He claims success as average gasoline prices in the U.S. have indeed declined, all the way from $4 to $3.80 a gallon. I would have thought God could do better than that, but I understand he is busy with other small problems, mostly centered in Africa and Asia, where people continue to war and starve. I have a humble suggestion for human intervention in the fuel price problem, if the problem it is. Rather than burden gods with the job, suppose we renationalize Petro-Canada, mandating our new company to sell its products to the public at a price representing a reasonable markup over production cost and without regard to prices charged by competitors. Is this radical? That is what Trudeau had in mind when he created the public corporation as an ideal deliberately sabotaged by the Conservatives and their foreign oil industry allies. Back in the early 20th century, alcohol was prohibited in the States. Gangsters found the trade in illegal booze very profitable. American cities found violence and corruption rampant, fostered by vast fortunes to be made in trafficking the stuff. Society finally woke up to the problem that prohibition fostered and legalized alcohol. Now bootlegging and illegal booze is rare. In both Canada and the States, desperate women went to back alley abortion mills to end unwanted pregnancies. Many died from botched abortions. We now have safe, legal abortions available, and untold numbers of women's lives have been saved. Illegal gambling was rampant in North America, with bookies raking in illicit, untaxed profits from the gullible and the addicted. For better or worse, the gambling racket was nationalized, with governments now on the take as private bookies and gambling joints disappeared. Has society learned the lessons from futile exercises in banning alcohol, abortion, and gambling? If so, the results haven't percolated up to the ranks of politicians. And maybe there's a rational thought behind a denial to deal with social problems without going to their root. By keeping common activities illegal, the police have targets that keep them from attacking serious crime. We would not want too many resources devoted to political corruption, collusion in pricing, tax evasion, environmental devastation, and other everyday activities of the rich. Let them go after street crime while feeding the statistics that make the average citizens live in fear, supporting those who promise to fight crime in the streets. Criminalizing activities have always been with us and always will, while pandering to the sanctimonious merely adds to social problems. Take the oldest profession, prostitution. We're in denial, pretending that this is a problem that is solvable. It is not. We can attack it or coddle it, but it'll always be here. We could ignore the simple fact, pushing street prostitutes from one neighborhood to another, prosecuting them and their johns when it pleases, but prostitution remains. Street prostitution spreads disease while corrupting officials, feeding street violence, and breeding a parasitical class of pimps. A simple solution applied by more civilized jurisdictions is to move prostitutes from the byways and alleys to brothels. There, they can be isolated from pimps while concentrated where they can have medical help to stem disease, psychological aid for the unbalanced, and social help to free them from addictions. But this makes too much sense and does not appeal to blue noses with delusions of superiority and access to divine truth. Then there are drugs. The parallel to experiences with prohibition of alcohol is close, but the lessons learned from that failed experiment have been lost on current leaders. Granted that the proliferation of designer drugs makes the problem of drugs more diverse than that of alcohol, a good start has been made in Vancouver with the creation of safe injection sites. Those wiser than our conservative masters established places where illegal street drugs could be used in sanitary conditions under medical supervision. There are junkies. There will always be junkies, just as there will always be alcoholics. Suck it up and deal with it in a rational manner. A saner society would go beyond safe injection sites to dispensing some drugs, especially opiates, to be used on-site under controlled conditions. It's long been known that persons addicted to opiates can lead normal, productive lives when dosages are maintained. I've read estimates that addicts on the street, living by their wits and theft, cost society between six and seven figures of dollars during their lifetimes in lost property, policing, courts, probation, medical, and prison costs. Add to that what society loses by not having these people being productive, and the piddling cost of running facilities to maintain their habits is insignificant. What stops us from implementing such places? Blue noses, know-nothings, and those whose jobs and incomes depend on the endless cycle of punishment and treatment. And where would society procure the opiates to maintain addicts? The same place the underworld does, Afghanistan. Instead of pissing off Afghans and feeding their rebellion, we could be outbidding those in the heroin trade, buying directly from Afghan farmers. With stable incomes guaranteed by the West, the loyalties of farmers would be rapidly switched from the Taliban, and half our war would be won. But don't expect our politicians, especially those self-styled conservatives, to do the sensible thing. There are votes to be garnered from citizens frightened by this war on drugs, just as there are from the oft-stoked fears of terrorism. If you purchased a baseball purportedly signed by Mother Teresa, you bought a fake. Sorry to have to be the one to break the sad news. I learned that the sale of sports memorabilia is now a $2 billion growing market. It is saturated with fraudulent items. In the United States, official concern is strong enough that the FBI had a program called Operation Bullpen, resulting in seizure of 10,000 baseballs bearing counterfeit signatures, including your ball with Mother Teresa's. Too bad for the counterfeiters that the Federal Bureau of Investigation had no more serious matters to attend to in the United States otherwise bereft of serious crimes. Investigators estimated that 75% of all sports and entertainment memorabilia are fakes. Want to see some? Check out your local Boston Pizza to see the joint festooned with sports jerseys and such that have never seen a playing field. Although I'm sure that such stuff was sanctioned by the sports corporations, it's still phony. As I was speaking of socially useful occupations for addicts, I cannot help but think of some 130 baseball memorabilia authenticators making a living at this trade. Those of you students who can't scribble a decent signature of Babe Ruth, take note when charting your career path. As for the signatures, think of all those little children in China who can't speak a word of English but can produce a good copy of a jock's autograph on a baseball. Not that Canada's lacking tricksters. Take the former CEO of Canfor, David Emerson, who chose to enter politics as a liberal. After winning a seat in the last federal election, Emerson saw which side of the bread the butter was on and switched loyalties to the ruling conservatives. In his new role as natural resources minister, David sold Canada out on a forestry deal, with the U.S. saddling us with a permanent export tax and limitations that are strangling our industry. Nice going, David. Certain soreheads in his riding did not adjust calmly to his switching parties. Remedies suggested range from impeachment to lynching, but David remains undeterred. He has given up on running again for his present seat, but he indicated he might seek re-election as soon as he can locate a riding where the voters don't give a hang what party their member of parliament represents. Some of us would dearly love to see this turncoat go down in flames. The Potash Corporation of Saskatchewan was created by the province as a crown corporation to exploit a publicly owned resource for the benefit of the people of Saskatchewan. It did a decent job of this until some self-styled conservatives, more interested in their own wealth than the actual conservation, sold it out to private interests. Just as in other cases where public operations were turned over to private ownership, the value of the Potash Corporation was suddenly found to be worth many times what was paid for it. Funny thing, the same thing happened in Russia with the fall of communism, but has been no stranger in Canada. Look what happened when they gave away the Canadian National Railway, the British Columbia Railway, BC Hydro's gas operations, Petro-Canada, and many others past, present, and I dare say, future. The Potash Corporation of Saskatchewan is now raking in such a windfall profit with the multiplying of fertilizer values that it has rewarded its top three executives with stock options worth $846 million. Well, good for them. They certainly earned every penny of that three-quarters-plus billion dollars. But there's a fly in the ointment. The greedy workers who mine and process the potash are rearing their ugly heads and demanding a share of the profits. My gods, the socialist hordes are at the gates. They're demanding a bonus, just as did those terrible rabble-rousers who won a bonus from Inco after a jump in nickel prices. The Potash Corporation is standing resolutely against any such bonus. A spokesman said they didn't want to saddle themselves with undue costs. When it comes to undue costs affecting the value of potash shares, perhaps this spokesman could have mentioned the issue of stock options. These arrangements, allowing executives to buy shares of stock at less than market value, dilute share ownership, and directly result in undue costs to shareholders. Ah, the wonders of capitalist enterprise, especially when it appropriates the efforts of public ownership and rides the crest of shortages to reward its masters. This concludes the 280th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo. I am Uncle Don, and this is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Catch rebroadcasts on CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake or CHLS in Lillooet.